I'm in touch with a lot of people in Lebanon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, Grindr is like a dating app that is based on location.
Oh.
So it's like they're by the border.
And the border is a bit of an obstacle to then meeting tonight.
Exactly.
With the eyes of the world on Gaza, one terror group now threatens to escalate this war into a wider regional conflict. That group is Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy militia in Lebanon. Since October 8th, it's been firing rockets at northern Israel. Nearly 100,000 Israelis are displaced from their homes, and they can't go back to homes that are being shelled. And that's why Israel is warning Hezbollah, back off, or we will push you away. You see, Hezbollah isn't supposed to be in southern Lebanon at all. Israel and Hezbollah have already fought a war back in 2006. That ended with a UN resolution that ordered Hezbollah to back off north of the Litani River. But Hezbollah ignored it, continued to take over the Lebanese state, build its military arsenal, and here we are years later with a monstrous terrorist army on our borders, making tens of thousands of Israelis refugees in their own country. My guest today, Jonathan El-Khoury, knows what it's like to be a refugee from his own country, because he was one of thousands of Lebanese citizens forced to flee as Hezbollah seized southern Lebanon 24 years ago. In 2000, the Israeli army withdrew from Lebanon. Its ally, the South Lebanon army, collapsed, and thousands of Christian anti-Hezbollah fighters and their families built new homes and lives in Israel. And Jonathan, like his native homeland, Lebanon, can look like a walking contradiction and enigma. Lebanese and Israeli. Christian and an LGBT activist. An advocate for Israel, speaking to Lebanese men just across the border on dating apps. Jonathan El-Khoury joins me here in the State of a Nation podcast studio to speak about his birth country, his life story, and the pressing threat of a potential war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Let's get cracking.
Breaking news out of Israel this morning.
Shocking hostage taking.
Hundreds of Israelis are dead.
I want to bring an Israeli government spokesman.
What happens when a four-day pause?
How do you resolve this?
Where does this go?
Jonathan El-Khoury, welcome to the State of a Nation podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Ilan.
I have to say, I'm so fascinated, intrigued by your story, your very idiosyncratic personality. I don't know how to introduce you on the podcast. What do I call you?
I'm known also as the gay goy guy.
The gay goy guy. Okay.
So you can go with that also.
That's quite a brand.
It is.
How did you get that name?
Well, I was always approached on social media as like this evil goy, using it as a slur for like the Jews or...
Who was calling you that?
Like anti-Israelis.
Anti-Israelis are calling you a goy?
Yeah, because they think that the Jews say the word goy as an insult. So they used to insult me, like, go to your, like, Jews that calls you goy. I'm like, but goy is just like a nation. It's like people that are non-Jewish. So I'm like, I adapted the slang.
Interesting. Okay, that's quite quite an introduction. you know, I think that I understand our conflict with the Palestinians. There's a reason why we have a conflict and interests at some level very much contradictory. I've always thought it's one of the biggest tragedies of the Middle East that Israel and Lebanon find themselves in a conflict because we have so much in common,
yeah.
No territorial dispute. And I always think Israelis love traveling up north to the very expensive Tzimarim, to the villages for a weekend, that if we had peace with Lebanon, people would just drive up across the border, go there for their countryside weekends and then come back. And of course, when you look at it historically, the fact that Israel and Lebanon could, in 1948, have forged some alliance of minorities in the Middle East between the Jewish state and what was then at least a majority Christian state. And it never happened. And that tragedy really weighs on me when I think about the potential impending conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in the north.
Yeah, it almost happened. Like it almost happened even like a few times, not only one time prior to 1948, when the high priest of Lebanon, the Maronite priest, was in a really good connection with the Israeli Yishuv. And they talked about the origin of the two-state solution, that there was one state for the Jewish people in the land of Israel and another state for the Christian Maronites in Lebanon. So that was kind of the connection and the talks between these two communities. that weren't independent. Lebanon was under the French colonialism, and the land of Israel was under the British colonialism. But then when Israel was reestablished in 1947 in the Declaration of Independence, Lebanon didn't really have a choice because the Arab world or united, all of them united against Israel, and they said they're going to declare war against Israel. And if Lebanon wouldn't join the Arab world in that, they would be next.
Right, so, the Lebanese minority was a majority in Lebanon at the time, decided to resolve that tension by siding with Arab nationalism instead of other minorities in the Middle East. And here we are where we are today. I want to circle back later and we'll talk about what is happening with Hezbollah and its aggression on the northern border. First, I really want to understand your personal story because it's so unusual in Israel to come across someone who is born in Lebanon, living now in Israel. You have minority within a minority in many other respects. Tell me your story. What? How did you get to Israel?
Oh, that's I think in some ways I wasn't supposed to be here, because my father was a part of the South Lebanon Army, that military that was formed in 1982 officially with the help of Israel, with the help of the Lebanese government, and also the UN was involved there with the Reagan administration back then. And
this was following the first Lebanon war, and Israel begins to draw down forces, creates a buffer zone in southern Lebanon, and relies on local partners in order to try to keep the peace and prevent Palestinians being able to use South Lebanon as a base for terrorism.
And that was an agreement that the Israeli government did with the Lebanese government. So that was something that wasn't, as any other militia. That was formed just by locals and they can act however they want. No, that was formed as part of the Lebanese military that was in alliance and collaboration with the Israeli Defense Forces. And they all collaborated together and worked together. My father joined that. And, the reason for the creation of that, not only because Israel wanted to have a buffer zone, but the whole connection with the locals in the south of Lebanon with the Christians and also Shia Muslims back then, that was because we suffered in Lebanon back then in the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, the same thing that happened on October 7th in the south of Israel.
What do you mean?
When the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, that is known as terrorist organization.
Yes, liberation, misleading term in that context.
Exactly. But when they were kicked out of Jordan because they were terrorizing the king and they tried to assassinate his life twice, so the king of Jordan had enough and he kicked them out of Jordan with Yasser Arafat and his associates, if you want to call them like that. They were relocated in south of Lebanon. Basically, what Jordan, Egypt, and Syria did is force Lebanon's hand to accept this terror group to relocate in their territory in order to attack Israel from its territory. But the Palestinian terror organization didn't stop with that.
And the Lebanese population very much regard the PLO as being this hostile intrusion from outside that had come to destabilize the peace within Lebanon.
Exactly. And they didn't want them there. So that's why there were a lot of militias starting to form in that time to kind of fight back against the PLO that started to relocate in the Christian villages, in the Shia villages, and they started to protect themselves. That's why my father joined the South Lebanon Army, because he wanted to protect his family and our home and our land. That was something that they did. And they realized that the only thing that they can do is to actually ask Israel for help and form this minorities alliance that was supposed to be formed back then
in the 40s. That should have been formed back in the 40s.
Exactly. That was their basis when they kind of ignited again this coalition with Israel. And it continued till May 2000, Israeli presence in south of Lebanon, fighting shoulder to shoulder with the Israeli IDF forces with the South Lebanon Army for 18 years.
And then in 2000, Israel finds itself withdrawing from Lebanon, and you find yourself also moving in into Israel with the withdrawal of Israeli forces. How did that happen?
Not at the time.
Not at the time. So
how did the story
unfold? I stayed
in Lebanon for another year and 3 months.
Interesting. And I want to embarrass you. So I want to embarrass you. We've managed to get our hands on your ID card from Lebanon.
This is exclusive.
And this is, and I'm using this in order to plug the podcast on YouTube as well for anyone who is listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, because you can't see it, but on YouTube you can see it. Little Jonathan, aged how old?
I think here was like 6 or 7.
6 or 7. Absolutely, yeah. Adorable. Absolutely with, massive
with the
ears.
Biggest
as well.
Ears that you could ever imagine.
And it's if like you want to see Dumbo. Jonathan Alcoury, age 6, with his massive ears, then please do watch the podcast.
I still
YouTube.
Have massive ears now, but kind of my head changed a little
Everything
bit.
Everything has reapportioned itself, yeah. Probably. So, okay. So as the Middle East reapportions itself in 2000 and Israel pulls out of Lebanon all the way to the blue line, what happens to the South Lebanon Army? What happens to the minorities that form these militias in order to protect their villages against the PLO once Israel, their protector, retreats back into Israeli territory?
Yeah, well, at the day of the withdrawal, the 23rd of May 2000, 8,000 people from the South Lebanon Army or their families found shelter in Israel that same day, because Israel did this speed withdrawal from South Lebanon in only 24 hours. And everyone that wanted to come and find shelter in Israel that was part of the South Lebanon Army was able to do that after, you know, waiting a few hours on the border. And 8,000 people, among them was my father. But we stayed in Lebanon after that. And
right, why do you stay in Lebanon?
Because my mom is a really independent, strong woman. And she told my dad that she wants to stay in Lebanon because this is our home. And that the main threat was on him and that he should move for a while, because everyone thought that there's going to be some sort of an agreement between the Israeli government and the Lebanese government.
That was what they were expecting at the time.
Yeah.
What sort of agreement?
That they will allow the South Lebanon Army fighters and soldiers that came to Israel to find immediate shelter to go back to Lebanon without getting any harm. But that wasn't the case. And the reason that all of this chaos happened in south of Lebanon, inside of the Lebanese side of it, was that Hassan Nasrallah, the head of the Hezbollah terrorist organization, 3 days prior to the withdrawal, said that the South Lebanon Army community and everyone that worked in Israel at the time, because we had thousands of workers coming from Lebanon to Israel, has three options. One option was to flee with the enemy to their state. The second option was to surrender to the Lebanese authorities. And everyone who did that was later on moved into a Hezbollah facility. That they were tortured. Some of them were killed because of that. They were murdered. Some of them were still in prison until today. And the third option was, if you don't choose these two options, you can just be slaughtered while you're hugging your own mother.
And is that why you say that the atrocities of October 7th reminded you of your childhood in southern Lebanon?
That was kind of what could have happened again if the Lebanese people wouldn't stop Hezbollah from doing that.
I mean, what sort of violence are we talking
but
about?
But in the 70s, the PLO did major atrocities to Christian villages. They slaughtered thousands of people. They even crucified some.
Crucified?
Crucified.
Literally in nailed a Damul them to
village.
A cross.
Yeah, in a Damul village, in an Aishiya village, where Palestinian terrorists came into these villages and just butchered everyone that came to their way.
I imagine then October 7th, you weren't particularly surprised then by the sort of barbarity and cruelty we saw from Hamas.
And you know, that was, I think, a few days after October 7th when I heard my mom speaking with her friend on the phone, and she told her that what happened on October 7th, this is the same thing that happened to us. And I think at that moment, it clicked and even connected me more to what is going on for us as Israelis, because it's some sort of this DNA of survival that we are carrying on. The Jewish people really known for carrying that DNA from ancient times till today. And there was something that suddenly I felt connected to that, because we went through the same thing. Our families went through the same thing. And all because of this extreme terror ideology that refuses to see the others and act with them and be able to kind of live peacefully together.
And that's the sort of terrorism your father flees from when he evacuates into Israel. You stay in Lebanon. And then how do we get from little boy with the big ears in Lebanon to sitting here in Israel as this hybrid, part of a very special minority, not many people can claim to say, Lebanese hyphen Israeli?
Yeah, we're only 3,500 people in Israel. That's all. We're a small, unique community. But my mom later on discovered that my dad shouldn't come to Lebanon because of all what happened to those who stayed. And we kind of started to plan our escape from Lebanon. We had to...
Escape?
Yeah, we had to plan it because the border was already shut. We can't just cross the border like my father did. And the only way to go and leave Lebanon was through the airport. And we didn't have passports. So we had to go through this half of year of like enormous paperwork because my father wasn't in the picture. And by Lebanese law, the father needs to sign for the children's papers to get passports.
And you can't exactly take the papers, do a paper airplane and throw them over the border
exactly.
into Israel.
And like, where's the father? He needs to be even like present, and just, not just sign it. And we had to go through this phase of at the end of the day, we were able to achieve passports. And we were able to flee Lebanon to Cyprus. And from Cyprus, we went to the Israeli consulate. And not only that I'm Lebanese living in Israel, but I entered Israel through Ben-Gurion Airport in August 2001 with my Lebanese passport.
With your Lebanese passport? Yeah. Please tell me you still have the passport.
I still do.
Stamped Ben-Gurion Airport.
That's a funny story. I asked my mom because I wanted to publish the story about us coming to Israel with the Israeli stamp on the Lebanese passport. And one of the things that I asked her a few years ago, like, hey, mom, where's the passports? I want to like take a picture of that. And she was like, oh, no, I asked them not to stamp the passport because we thought that we might go back to Lebanon and I don't want to make any trouble with us coming back. That was the state of mind.
Fascinating.
After fleeing to a foreign country with two kids, with me and my brother, and fleeing from there to Israel, she still thought that one day we will go back to Lebanon and we will use this passport.
And you haven't been back to Lebanon since?
No, you're can't.
You can't?
I can't.
Are you in touch with friends, family in Lebanon?
I'm in touch with a lot of people in Lebanon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I used to live in Nahariya.
Okay.
Nahariya, it's like 10 kilometers away from the border.
Okay.
Grindr would get a lot would get a lot of Lebanese next to the border.
Can you tell where they are, that they're in Lebanon?
Well, Grindr is like a dating app that is based on location. So you know that it's like in a 10 kilometer wide. So it's like they're by the border.
Okay.
You can't tell exactly where their location is.
And the border is a bit of an obstacle to then meeting tonight.
Exactly.
What sort of conversation? I mean, don't get too graphic, but what sort of conversations are you able to have with, you know, other gay men living in Lebanon, only 10 kilometers away in your original homeland?
Yeah, well, actually, if you want to be surprised, like a lot of them are really interested in what's going on in Israel, like for gay life. Like, because they heard about it, they heard about the gay parade that we have in Tel Aviv and everything. And they know that we are advanced in LGBTQ+ rights. We're not perfect. We don't have everything, but we're still advanced in that. And they're always interested to hearing more about the daily day life. Like, how is our families with it? How is the society with it? So I would have fascinating conversations about that. But some people would just curse me because I'm Israeli and I'm Lebanese because I have both flags on my profile, the Lebanese and Israeli flag.
Fascinating.
So some of them would be like, delete the Lebanese flag like next to this barbaric flag of the Israeli flag.
Do you think of yourself as a refugee?
For 24 hours.
That's it?
Yeah.
24 hours a day or
no,
for the first 24
for
hours?
For the first 24 hours.
And
because
then what
I wasn't actually a refugee that long. Just, you know, Cyprus and then Israel. But the next day we went to the Ministry of Interior and we got our paperwork, our Israeli paperwork.
And President Herzog played a significant role in that story and you met him recently. How did that go?
Actually, I met him. I requested to meet with him with another youth from the South Lebanon Army community because we are already here in Israel 24 years since the withdrawal from South Lebanon. And Yitzhak Herzog, the president of Israel, he was a member of parliament back then. And as part of him being in, you could say also the party that was responsible for the withdrawal of South Lebanon from the Avodah, mm-hmm. from the Labor Party, he made the bill that kind of legalized our status in Israel. And the bill of 2004 of the South Lebanon Army community and their families. And that basically said that we are Israeli citizens 100% and we're equal to the law and we can be as any other Israeli citizen.
Extraordinary. So the very small community of Lebanese Christians in Israel, they serve in the army? I mean, what is their integration within Israeli society?
Yeah, we have 95% of enlistment to the military or national service.
Is that conscription or volunteering?
Volunteering. Although we receive a draft of the IDF.
Okay.
But at the day when we go to do all the process, they ask us at the end of the day if you want to continue with drafting or not. And for example, I wasn't really sure about my military service. I was like super in the closet back then. I'm like really afraid of what's going on. I didn't really know how advanced the military was back then to really search online.
In terms of gay rights, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I didn't know that we already had, like, the first officer in the IDF, that I can request some sort of things to assist me, like, with separate showers or stuff like that. I didn't know that because I didn't really search. I was, like, super in the closet, mm-hmm. coming from this Christian kind of religious family that doesn't really support that. And so I requested not to continue drafting to the IDF, and I was, like, granted it immediately because by law, we're not obligated to do that, but it's an option. So I did national service for 2 years because I believe that every citizen needs to contribute to the society that they live in. And that was something that I was taught by my dad, that this is our place of living now. Israel is our home. We need to do everything in our power in order to be part of that society. I can't just sit aside and complain all day about some things that are mistreated. And I need to be vocal. I need to do that. So
it's a very healthy ethic. And I think it's wonderful to see a minority community committed to integration and serving, even though you come with this story of, as you say, being a refugee, but only for 24 hours.
Yeah, like it's a minority inside of a minority in some sort of way.
John, that we could sit, like, I would really like to sit and schmooze and understand more about your story. And you know what? Maybe we'll catch up later over drinks.
Yeah.
But I want to, we're in a war. And I want to understand a bit more about the geopolitical context of what is happening now. Because after the October 7 massacre, Hezbollah decided to join this war on the side of Hamas. It's been firing thousands of rockets into northern Israel, displacing close to 100,000 Israelis who are now refugees mm-hmm. in their own land. They can't go back to their homes. Those homes are being shelled. We spent a long time, I did so many of these press conferences, warning, we don't want a war on two fronts. Please desist. We're ready to fight if we have to, but we really don't want to. And now we're warning, you know, we're at a fork in the road. Either Hezbollah backs off, or we're going to have to push it away through military force if necessary, because we need our people to return safely to their homes, and no country can accept this kind of aggression. So I want to understand how you see how we got here. What is Hezbollah playing at? What is it trying to achieve with this aggression against communities in northern Israel? And, you know, you live in Haifa, in Nahariya. These are places that are going to be very seriously hit if an all-out war happens with Hezbollah, a war that we very much hope can be avoided through a diplomatic resolution. But we're realistic about the prospects for that. So how do you see Hezbollah's involvement in this war? Why does it seem hell-bent on dragging Lebanon into a totally unnecessary war on Hamas's side?
Well, I think first we need to understand Hezbollah's role inside of Lebanon's politics and how they control a lot of, like, the public opinion that goes on in Lebanon. Because they didn't just, you know, rise up from nowhere. They started in the beginning of the 80s, when Israel was still in south of Lebanon fighting the PLO. And it started like Hamas started at the beginning, as a social organization. They started to take care of the Shia community in Lebanon that was really oppressed by both the Lebanese authorities, but also oppressed by the PLO. There's this famous fight that's called the fight of the camps, of the refugee camps in Lebanon, that was fights between the Sunni and the Shia, and Hezbollah took huge part of it. Well, more than 1,500 Palestinians were killed out of that war. And that was something that they started to establish their presence in Lebanon later on, not only as this social organization that helps their community, but also as the protector of Lebanon. The protector of Lebanon in a sense where...
Protector of Lebanon from whom?
Exactly.
And on whose behalf?
Exactly. So how they imaged that, and they were able to actually caught a lot of support because of that, is because Israel stayed in Lebanon from 82 till May 2000. It's 18 years. So for
with
example,
a security zone in southern Lebanon, which the SLA.
So for us, the Israelis, and for the South Lebanon Army community, it's really reasonable why Israel stayed in south of Lebanon out of security, because after kicking the PLO out of Lebanon, Hezbollah suddenly took power and started fighting against Israeli troops and against the South Lebanon Army soldiers as well.
And you're saying it begins sort of as this authentic Lebanese Shia movement.
Yes.
At least at the beginning.
At the beginning.
And then what happens?
And then around 82, they started to be formed more as a terror organization properly by taking control in high positions in Lebanon, by gaining more weapons and power. Today, Hezbollah has more weapons than the Lebanese military. This is how strong they are. They're controlling some
Resolution
areas in Lebanon.
Resolution 1701, which ended the 2006 war, says that there's supposed to be no military presence other than the Lebanese armed forces south of the Litani River, that Hezbollah must retreat north of the Litani River, whereas in reality, Hezbollah is the only military presence in southern Lebanon.
Not only in south of Lebanon, but Hezbollah's presence, and they kind of have some sort of an autonomy, like this ex-territory inside of Lebanon, in south of Lebanon, in the north of Lebanon, also with the border with Syria. Also, they have the Beirut port that they have 100% control of. And this is something that Hezbollah is making sure that not only they take control of these territories, but there's no Lebanese presence in these territories.
So we have a Hezbollah military presence, especially in southern Lebanon. This Hezbollah state within a state linked to organized crime in Lebanon, across a lot of South America, links in Europe as well. But it's also deeply integrated into Lebanese politics and controlling the Lebanese state. What is Hezbollah's involvement in Lebanese politics?
Well, they are in the parliament. They have around 20 something seats in the Lebanese parliament. They are ministers. They have ministers that are affiliated with Hezbollah and they support Hezbollah. The number of parliament representatives that Hezbollah has gives them a lot of power, that their vote is super important for every coalition that is going to be formed in Lebanon. So that's why, for example, in every government, you will find Hezbollah there because this is their votes. No one can gain.
And at the moment, what is Hezbollah's relationship with the Lebanese government?
They are in the government.
Hezbollah is a member of the Lebanese government.
They are members of the Lebanese government.
So when we talk about this division between there's Hezbollah and then there's the Lebanese armed forces, the Lebanese armed forces are also in some way subordinate to Hezbollah?
Yeah, because there's many Hezbollah supporters that are inside of the military, of the Lebanese military, but also the military kind of answers to the government. So if they are part of the government, this is kind of what takes the way. So that's
is it wrong then to think of this division between, look, there's Lebanon and then there's Hezbollah, which is present in Lebanon. Are Hezbollah and Lebanon essentially one and the same now?
Well, yeah, you can say that. You can say that. I always believed that back then it was two separate things. It was a terror organization that is being kind of controlling in some territories of the Lebanese government. But today they are part of the Lebanese government. Although I have to say that we are hearing a lot of voices from inside of the Lebanese parliament against Hezbollah's presence in south of Lebanon or in control of their territories. I hear, for example, just 2 weeks ago, the head priest of Lebanon, the Maronite priest, Rai, that's his name, he went and spoke against Hezbollah's presence in south of Lebanon because he said that we refuse to be hostages of Hezbollah. We refuse to be human shields.
Very interesting choice of language given what's happening in Gaza.
He uses that because he knows and he sees that on the ground that Hezbollah is present mainly in Christian villages in south of Lebanon. They're taking control of Christian villages.
And they feel safe using this language against Hezbollah?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's not the first time that the head priest of Lebanon uses that language. And he also called, as you mentioned before, to follow that 1701 resolution.
Do you think that can be effective? Because we very much hope at the moment that we can avoid a war with Hezbollah. We know that the consequences will be absolutely catastrophic.
Yeah.
In Israel, in Lebanon, we hope it will be possible to have a diplomatic resolution that will see that UN Security Council resolution enforced, Hezbollah pushed away from the northern border. And we've been warning for 4 months about what the consequences of this war will be if Hezbollah drags us into a full-scale war, in the hope that it will generate the political pressure within Lebanon where people will take Hezbollah, shake it by the shoulders and say, you are insane, you are psychopaths, you are lunatics, you are going to drag us into a destructive war. Please, for the love of God, go north of the Litani River, enforce that UN resolution so that we can avoid an unnecessary war. Is Hezbollah receptive to that pressure? How much pressure are we seeing? Are you optimistic about the hopes for a political resolution of the crisis?
I think one of the first things that we need to understand is that I think Hezbollah would have responded in a much more higher scale if it wasn't for a lot of the Lebanese opposition against Hezbollah.
You think the Lebanese opposition has already slowed down and yes. moderated what would otherwise have been worse Hezbollah aggression?
Because the last two speeches that Hezbollah gave in the last month was mainly, particularly his language, was to the Lebanese people. He usually goes and talks about the geopolitical affairs. He talks a lot about Israel, about what's going on. But particularly his last two speeches were targeting the Lebanese population.
What was his message to them?
His message was trying to kind of tell them why he's doing what he's doing, to support Hamas, to support the Palestinians. He's trying to kind of persuade the Lebanese to say, oh yeah, you're suffering, but it's you're suffering because it's for a good reason. But not a lot of Lebanese are buying it. We saw that in the head priest speech just 2 weeks ago. And we've seen that from Israeli, from Lebanese politicians. We've seen that from news anchors that goes out and speak out.
There's These are not necessarily people who want normalization
exactly.
with Israel, but definitely do not want Hezbollah to drag them into a war.
Because they know that this will lead to Lebanon's destruction. They know that Hezbollah's action will lead to the destruction of Lebanon. They remember the 2006 war when tons of ammunition were bombed on southern Beirut. They remember what happened to south of Lebanon.
So why is Hezbollah doing this? What really, I'm genuinely not managing to understand what Hezbollah's interest is in entering this war on the side of Hamas.
Well, you have to remember that Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran. Hezbollah is not acting on its own.
That's the elephant in the room here, the Iranian regime.
Exactly.
And we often talk about Hezbollah and Hamas being twin sisters.
Yeah, Hezbollah is Shia and Hamas are Sunni Muslims. You have the Houthis in Yemen.
How nice to see that they can unite when the common enemy is the Jews.
Exactly. And that's why they're united, because there's an ongoing war between the Muslim Sunni and the Muslim Shia worldwide in the Muslim world. But suddenly when it comes to Israel, you can see that Hamas, as a Sunni Muslim religious organization, terrorist organization, is connected with the Shia Muslim terrorist organization in Lebanon, with the Houthis that are also a proxy of Iran, that is a Muslim Shia a terrorist organization. So this is all kind of the bigger, wider plan of Iran taking control of a lot of these territories.
So is Hezbollah simply acting at the behest of Iran? It's a proxy that Iran has a button and says, Hezbollah, you should do this. And Hezbollah then acts like a puppet on a string and does whatever Iran says? Or is this more of an alliance between Iran and Hezbollah? I'm really trying to understand what they are trying to achieve, when it is clear how destructive such a war will be if it happens and we're not able to avoid it and deter Hezbollah.
Well, Hezbollah 100% answers to the Iranian regime.
It's a sir, yes sir arrangement?
Of course, but they also kind of gives them a lot of benefits in Lebanon, or to kind of gain their support in Lebanon. Because, for example, when in Lebanon they had the petrol crisis 2 years ago, who was there to assist the Lebanese people? Because Hassan Nasrallah requested, it was Iran. Iran sent ships with petrol to Lebanon in order to assist them with that. So that's kind of a circle of things that goes around. And Hezbollah 100% answers to the Iranian regime. Lebanon doesn't really care. Hezbollah doesn't care about Lebanon as much as they care about what his answers or requests that comes from Iran.
You know who else doesn't care about Lebanon? All the Palestinian people?
Oh, no one cares about Lebanon.
No one.
No one, not even the Arab world. Because when we suffered in the 70s, no one cared about Lebanon from the Arab world. Or the Eastern world, you can say also.
Well, I was going to say
this
protesters.
Is Lebanon's strategy.
I was going to start with protesters on Western campuses and streets around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Who have been protesting in solidarity with the terrorist organizations that have been
lovely.
Sowing havoc and chaos. So I have here a couple of clips
from
protests around the world that have been identifying and expressing solidarity with these terrorist organizations. You've been very active as well, speaking up on these issues. So I want to pick your brains and see what you think about this. So we have a clip here from Columbia University. Let's play the clip. There is only one solution, Intifada Revolution. Wow. What do you think when you hear these, privileged people on Western campuses and streets calling for a campaign of suicide bombings against civilian targets? Is that a fair way to describe Intifada Revolution?
Yeah, this is, I think, the most accurate definition of Intifada, because this is what is known in Israel as the Intifada, where you had Palestinian terrorists putting suicide bomb vests, going into buses, restaurants, clubs, and just detonating themselves and killing innocent people.
An Intifada that didn't go particularly well for the Palestinian people, because let's remember that this came just a few years after Israel had withdrawn from Palestinian towns in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. And the consequence of the Intifada was Operation Defensive Shield, when Israel had to go back and reclaim these towns to stamp out Palestinian terrorism. If we go back to Lebanon, we have here another clip from Washington, D.C., where you see a chap with a keffiyeh, which has become a very trendy fashion symbol, carrying the Hezbollah flag, together with, I think that's a Palestinian flag he's unfolding.
Or
on
Jordanian, a lot of them don't know.
That one doesn't have the star on it. That's a Palestinian flag. How do you feel as a Lebanese man when you see people around the world carrying the flag of this fanatical, zealous, virulently homophobic terrorist organization?
Well, you know, I kind of feel sorry for these people, because on one hand, I know that they mean good, in a way that they want to, they want to feel that they're on the good side of the spectrum.
Yes, that happens with virtue signaling. People feel smug.
Yeah, they feel that they know better. They feel that they have all the knowledge, that they know who they're supporting. So they're comfortable in going on the street and chanting Intifada, we support the Intifada, although they have no clue what is the meaning of Intifada. Or when we go and we hear from the river to the sea or other chants, these are comfortable people that want to be trendy, that wants to kind of be loved by their peers and want to be, you know, part of the group.
I don't know. Identifying support for Hezbollah is a funny way to find love. I don't know. What are you finding on Grindr on the Lebanese border? What would you say to this man?
Well, Grindr has the similar colors of Hezbollah flags. So I don't know. Maybe we should think about that.
What would you say to this man as a Lebanese Israeli, as a gay man? What would you say to this man on the streets of Washington, D.C. carrying a Hezbollah flag?
So usually this kind of man describes himself as a human rights activist. And I kind of would want to go to him and say, I'm sorry to inform you, but you're in the opposite from a human rights supporter. Because not only that they're supporting a terror organization that terrorized innocent civilians in Lebanon, but is also involved with terrorizing innocent Israeli civilians and Lebanese civilians, also Syrians. They've been involved in the wars in Syria. They've been involved in the war in Iraq. And this is something that they need to be aware of. It's easy to kind of just look at the title and say, oh, okay, they're defending the Palestinians, so they're okay. This is a really wrong way to look at things, especially about groups in the Middle East.
Let's take a look at the next image. This is from Toronto. And again, you can't see this on the podcast, so again, using this as a plug to move people towards YouTube platform. From Toronto, Jesus was Palestinian, with a picture of a man who looks like every Israeli barista you've ever seen serving you
it's
up
a nice AI
your
pick,
double
by the
espresso
way.
In Florentine. What do you make of this Jesus was a Palestinian movement?
This is, again, a try to rewrite history, but not only to rewrite history, but to rewrite the whole concept of Christianity or who Jesus was.
By interpreting Christianity through the lens of Palestinian nationalism.
Exactly. But not only that, by mentioning the Palestinians that weren't even invented in the time of Jesus, or weren't even in the area, or wasn't even mentioned once during Jesus' time, as the Christian faith says that. And that's something that, in my opinion, they're trying to kind of persuade the Christian world in saying, hey, this is what is going on. They're doing that to your Christ. This is how they did. The Palestinian anti-Israeli movement have been doing that for more than 20 years. They've been trying to say to the African-American community in the States, hey, what we are suffering is the same thing that you're suffering from white nationalists in the States. Mm-hmm. The same thing with the Hispanic community in the States. The same thing with what's going on with South Africa, for example.
And so by trying to, for the Palestinian activists to try to link their own suffering to other struggles, they're linking it to the struggle of Jesus Christ himself against the Jews who throughout history have been accused of murdering him. And you
because
see,
this is what their this is their target, to kind of remind them in quotes that the Jews killed Jesus. They crucified him.
But how could the Jews have killed Jesus if they were all Palestinians too?
That's a good question.
That's a good question. Yeah. Let's move on to the next.
Kind of something that I want to really like put in for the Christians that are listening, or from other people that don't really understand Christianity and what the Christian faith is built on, is that Christ was supposed to be crucified. This is the whole Christian belief is built on it. I'm not
that
acting
Jesus
here.
Was brought to earth in order to
exactly. So why would we accuse anyone of his crucifixion?
Fascinating theological debate, but I want to show you another clip here from again from Columbia University.
Oh, this is
It doesn't rhyme, but nevertheless, let's listen.
Columbia
to it.
Is in the top of the charts of the anti-Israeli movement.
Yemen, Yemen, make us proud, turn another ship around. I saw a headline just this morning about how the Houthi pirate authorities in Yemen feel about pride, with a court there ordering the execution of a dozen individuals for the crime of homosexuality. How do you feel when you see people around the world, as a gay Arab yourself, chanting in favor of such a virulently homophobic terrorist regime?
This again shows me how ignorant people are, that they just go in the street chanting, supporting a terror organization that they have no clue what do they stand for or what they are supporting. This is the same thing that goes on with human rights movements, with women movements, that goes on and kind of vocally supports Hamas, that not only is acting against women, but also acting against LGBTQ plus community. With the Houthis, the same thing. Houthis are a really known terrorist organization in the Middle East, but suddenly the Western movement have discovered the Houthis because they support Hamas and their war against Israel. And suddenly
it doesn't matter how many sex slaves they have and how many children they starve. If they're against the Jews, then that
exactly.
makes them popular.
But not only against the Jews, but the Houthis flag literally says on its flag, death to America, death to Israel, and God curse the Jews. That's the translation of their flag from Arabic. So these are probably Americans that are chanting that on Columbia University. So what are they chanting for? Their own destruction?
Ironic, isn't it?
It is.
Jonathan, there are so many questions we can discuss, and I'm sure we'll have to have you on later on in the show to discuss a whole bunch of other questions we don't have time for. I'm sure you have a lot of mixed feelings about having essentially been chased out of Lebanon, being a refugee briefly, finding a new home in Israel. Personally, I'm glad that you found a new home in Israel. And I'm wondering, it's a question you must ask yourself all the time. Do you think you'll be able to visit Lebanon one day? Will we have peace with our neighbors in the north and live like normal neighbors, and you can drive over to Lebanon for the weekend?
I really hope so. I mean, this is my dream, to have a weekend in Lebanon and to do ski in Lebanon, because the Hermon side that we have also in Israel, the better part of it is in Lebanon, the bigger part. And that's something that I always wanted to visit from the Lebanese side. I always wanted to go there and, like, you know, go for a ski and then go to the beach in Beirut. But this is kind of what I really call for and hope for. I really believe that we will have peace, because I do believe that Lebanese people, the actual Lebanese people, do believe that their own salvation will come only by having peace with Israel, by having a normalization with Israel. Because that way, Lebanon will be able to thrive again and become
Absolutely.
The Switzerland of the Middle East, like it used to be in the 70s, before the civil war and before of all the wars that happened in Lebanon. And that's something that is achievable. And the Lebanese knows that. They just need to be able to be strong enough in order to push Hezbollah's back and to prevent Iran from basically building Iranian settlements inside of Lebanese territories.
And that really brings us full circle back to the tragedy of the fact that Israel and Lebanon do not have peaceful relations, to countries of minorities without a territorial dispute that have this conflict because of Iran's imperial policy of aggression in the Middle East, religious fanaticism. Jonathan, from your mouth to God's ears, thank you very much for joining me on State of the Nation. Thank you. And that brings us to the end of today's episode of the State of a Nation podcast. Please subscribe and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be back soon with more news and analysis and interesting discussions about the state of our nation.